This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Chemist, written by Stephanie Meyer, read by Ellen Archer. This book is dedicated to Jason Bourne and Aaron Cross, and also to Asya Muchnik and Megan Hibbett, for gleefully aiding and abetting my obsession. Chapter 1. Today's errand had become routine for the woman who was presently calling herself Chris Taylor. She'd gotten up much earlier than she liked, then dismantled and stowed her usual nighttime precautions. It was a real pain to set everything up in the evening, only to take it down first thing in the morning, but it wasn't worth her life to indulge in a moment of laziness. After this daily chore, Chris had gotten into her unremarkable sedan, more than a few years old but lacking any large-scale damage to make it memorable, and driven for hours and hours. She'd crossed 3 major borders and countless minor map lines, and even after reaching approximately the right distance, rejected several towns as she passed. That one was too small. That one had only 2 roads in and out. That one looked as though it saw so few visitors that there would be no way for her not to stand out, despite all of the ordinariness she worked to camouflage herself with. She took note of a few places she might want to return to another day, a welding supply shop, an army surplus store, and a farmer's market. Peaches were coming back in season. She should stock up. Finally, late in the afternoon, she arrived in a bustling place she'd never been before. Even the public library was doing a fairly brisk business. She liked to use a library when it was possible. Free was harder to trace. She parked on the west side of the building, out of sight of the one camera located over the entrance. Inside, the computers were all taken and several interested parties were hanging around waiting for a station, so she did some browsing, looking through the biography section for anything pertinent. She found that she'd already read everything that might be of use. Next, she hunted up the latest from her favorite espionage writer, a former Navy SEAL, and then grabbed a few of the adjacent titles. As she went to find a good seat to wait in, she felt a twinge of guilt. It was just so tawdry, somehow, stealing from a library. But getting a library card here was out of the question for a number of reasons, and there was the off chance that something she read in these books would make her safer. Safety always trumped guilt. It wasn't that she was unaware that this was 99% pointless. It was extremely unlikely that anything fictional would be of real, concrete use to her. But she'd long ago worked her way through the more fact-based kind of research available. In the absence of A-list sources to mine, she'd settled for the Z-list. It made her more panicky than usual when she didn't have something to study. And she'd actually found a tip that seemed practical in her last haul. She'd already begun incorporating it into her routine. She settled into a faded armchair in an out-of-the-way corner that had a decent view of the computer cubicles and pretended to read the top book in her pile. She could tell from the way several of the computer users had their belongings sprawled across the desk, one had even removed his shoes, that they would be in place for a long while. The most promising station was being used by a teenage girl with a stack of reference books and a harried expression. The girl didn't seem to be checking social media. She was actually writing down titles and authors generated by the search engine. While she waited, Chris kept her head bent over her book, holding it nestled in the crook of her left arm. With the razor blade hidden in her right hand, she neatly sliced off the magnetic sensor taped to the spine and stuffed it into the crevice between the cushion and the arm of the chair. Feigning a lack of interest, she moved on to the next book in the pile. Chris was ready, her denuded novels already stowed away in her backpack, when the teenage girl left to go find another source. Without jumping up or looking like she'd rushed, Chris was in the chair before any of the other lingering hopefuls even realized their chance had passed. Actually checking her email usually took about 3 minutes. After that, she would have another 4 hours, if she wasn't driving evasively, to get back to her temporary home. Then, of course, the reassembly of her safeguards before she could finally sleep. Email day was always a long one. Though there was no connection between her present life and this email account, no repeat IP address, no discussion of places or names, as soon as she was done reading and, if the occasion called for it, answering her mail, she would be out the door and speeding out of town, putting as many miles between herself and this location as possible, just in case. Just in case had become Chris's unintentional mantra. She lived a life of over-preparation, but, as she often reminded herself, without that preparation, she wouldn't be living a life at all. It would be nice not to have to take these risks, but the money wasn't going to last forever. Usually she would find a menial job at some mom-and-pop place, preferably one with handwritten records, but that kind of job generated only enough money for the basics, food and rent. Never the more expensive things in her life, like fake IDs, laboratory apparatus, and the various chemical components she hoarded. So she maintained a light presence on the internet, found her rare paying client here and there, and did everything she could to keep this work from bringing her to the attention of those who wanted her to stop existing. The last 2 email days had been fruitless, so she was pleased to see a message waiting for her, pleased for the approximately 2/10 of a second it took her to process the return address. L.Karsten.463@dpt11a.net. Just out there. His real email address, easily traceable directly to her former employers. As the hair rose on the back of her neck and the adrenaline surged through her body, run, 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 it seemed to be shouting inside her veins. Part of her was still able to gape in disbelief at the arrogance. She always underestimated how astonishingly careless they could be. They can't be here yet. She reasoned with herself through the panic, her eyes already sweeping the library for men with shoulders too broad for their dark suits, for military haircuts, for anyone moving toward her position. She could see her car through the plate glass window, and it looked like no one had tampered with it, but she hadn't exactly been keeping watch, had she? So they'd found her again. But they had no way of knowing where she would decide to check her mail. She was religiously random about that choice. Just now, an alarm had gone off in a tidy gray office, or maybe several offices, maybe even with flashing red lights. Of course, there would be a priority command set up to trace this IP address. Bodies were about to be mobilized. But even if they used helicopters, and they had that capability, she had a few minutes, enough to see what Karsten wanted. The subject line was, "Tired of running? Bastard." She clicked it open. The message wasn't long. "Policy has changed. We need you. Would an unofficial apology help? Can we meet? I wouldn't ask, but lives are on the line. Many, many lives." She'd always liked Karsten. He seemed more human than a lot of the other dark suits the department employed. Some of them, especially the ones in uniform, were downright scary. Which was probably a hypocritical thought, considering the line of work she used to be in. So of course it was Karsten they'd had make contact. They knew she was lonely and frightened, and they'd sent an old friend to make her feel all warm and fuzzy. Common sense, and she probably would have seen through the ploy without help, but it didn't hurt that the same ploy had been used once in a novel she'd stolen. She allowed herself one deep breath and 30 seconds of concentrated thought. The focus was supposed to be her next move, getting out of this library, this town, this state, as soon as possible, and whether that was enough. Was her current identity still safe, or was it time to relocate again? However, that focus was derailed by the insidious idea of Karsten's offer. What if this really was a way to get them to leave her alone? What if her certainty that this was a trap was born from paranoia and reading too much spy fiction? If the job was important enough, maybe they would give her back her life in exchange. Unlikely. Still, there was no point in pretending that Karsten's email had gone astray. She replied the way she figured they were hoping she would, though she'd formed only the barest outline of a plan. Tired of a lot of things, Karsten. Where we first met, 1 week from today, noon. If I see anyone with you, I'm gone, yada yada yada. I'm sure you know the drill. Don't be stupid. She was on her feet and walking in the same moment, a rolling lope she'd perfected, despite her short legs, that looked a lot more casual than it was. She was counting off the seconds in her head, estimating how long it would take a helicopter to cover the distance between D.C. and this location. Of course, they could alert locals, but that wasn't usually their style. Not their usual style at all, and yet, she had an unfounded but still pressingly uncomfortable feeling that they might be getting tired of their usual style. It hadn't yielded the results they were looking for, and these were not patient people. They were used to getting what they wanted exactly when they wanted it, and they'd been wanting her dead for 3 years. This email was certainly a policy change, if it was a trap. She had to assume it was. That viewpoint, that way of framing her world, was the reason she was still breathing in and out. But there was a small part of her brain that had already begun to foolishly hope. It was a small-stakes game she was playing. She knew that. Just one life. Just her life. And this life she'd preserved against such overpowering odds was just that, and nothing more. Life. The very barest of the basics. One heart beating, one set of lungs expanding and contracting. She was alive, yes, and she had fought hard to stay that way. But during her darker nights, she'd sometimes wondered what exactly she was fighting for. Was the quality of life she maintained worth all this effort? Wouldn't it be relaxing to close her eyes and not have to open them again? Wasn't an empty black nothing slightly more palatable than the relentless terror and constant effort? Only one thing had kept her from answering yes, and taking one of the peaceful and painless exits readily available to her, and that was an overdeveloped competitive drive. It had served her well in medical school, and now it kept her breathing. She wasn't going to let them win. There was no way she would give them such an easy resolution to their problem. They would probably get her in the end, but they were going to have to work for it, damn them. And they would bleed for it, too. She was in the car now, and 6 blocks from the closest freeway entrance. There was a dark ball cap over her short hair, wide-framed men's sunglasses covering most of her face, and a bulky sweatshirt disguising her slender figure. To a casual observer, she would look a lot like a teenage boy. The people who wanted her dead had already lost some blood, and she found herself suddenly smiling as she drove, remembering. It was odd how comfortable she was with killing people these days, how satisfying she found it. She had become bloodthirsty, which was ironic, all things considered. She'd spent 6 years under their tutelage, and in all that time, they hadn't come close to breaking her down, to turning her into someone who enjoyed her work. But 3 years on the run from them had changed a lot of things. She knew she wouldn't enjoy killing an innocent person. She was sure that corner had not been turned, nor would it be. Some people in her line of work, her former line, were well and truly psychotic, but she liked to think that this was the reason her peers were not as good as she was. They had the wrong motivations. Hating what she did gave her the power to do it best. In the context of her current life, killing was about winning. Not the entire war, just one small battle at a time. But each was still a win. Someone else's heart would stop beating and hers would keep going. Someone would come for her, and instead of a victim, he would find a predator. A brown recluse spider, invisible behind her gossamer trap. This was what they had made her. She wondered if they took any pride at all in their accomplishment, or if there was only regret that they hadn't stomped on her fast enough. Once she was a few miles down the interstate, she felt better. Her car was a popular model, 1,000 identical vehicles on the highway with her now, and the stolen plates would be replaced as soon as she found a safe spot to stop. There was nothing to tie her to the town she'd just left. She'd passed 2 exits and taken a 3rd. If they wanted to blockade the freeway, they'd have no idea where to do it. She was still hidden, still safe, for now. Of course, driving straight home was out of the question at this point. She took 6 hours on the return, twisting around various highways and surface roads, constantly checking to be sure there was no one following. By the time she finally got back to her little rented house, the architectural equivalent of a jalopy, she was already half asleep. She thought about making coffee, weighing the benefits of the caffeine boost against the burden of one extra task, and decided to just muscle through it on the vapors of her energy supply. She dragged herself up the 2 rickety porch steps, automatically avoiding the rot-weakened spot on the left of the first tread, and unlocked the double deadbolts on the steel security door she'd installed her first week living here. The walls, just wooden studs, drywall, plywood, and vinyl siding, didn't provide the same level of security, but statistically, intruders went for the door first. The bars on the windows were not an insurmountable obstacle either, but they were enough to motivate the casual cat burglar to move on to an easier target. Before she twisted the handle, she rang the doorbell. 3 quick jabs that would look like 1 continuous push to anyone watching. The sound of the Westminster chimes was only slightly muffled by the thin walls. She stepped through the door quickly, holding her breath just in case. There was no quiet crunch of broken glass, so she exhaled as she shut the door behind her. The home security was all her own design. The professionals she'd studied in the beginning had their own methods. None of them had her specialized skill set. Neither did the authors of the various novels she used as implausible manuals now. Everything else she had needed to know had been easy to pull up on YouTube. A few parts from an old washing machine, a microcontroller board ordered online, a new doorbell, and a couple of miscellaneous acquisitions, and she had herself a solid booby trap. She locked the deadbolts behind her and hit the switch closest to the door to turn on the lights. It was set in a panel with 2 other switches. The middle was a dummy. The 3rd switch, the farthest from the door, was patched into the same low-voltage signal wire as the doorbell. Like that fixture and the door, the panel of switches was newer by decades than anything else in the small front room that was living area, dining room, and kitchen combined. Everything looked as she'd left it. Minimal, cheap furnishings. Nothing big enough for an adult to hide behind. Empty counters and tabletop, no ornaments or artwork. Sterile. She knew that even with the avocado and mustard vinyl flooring and the popcorn ceiling, it still looked a little like a laboratory. Maybe the smell was what made it feel like a lab. The room was so scrupulously sanitary, an intruder would probably attribute the pool supply store scent to cleaning chemicals. But only if he got inside without triggering her security system. If he triggered the system, he wouldn't have time to register many details about the room. The rest of the house was just a small bedroom and bathroom, set in a straight line from the front door to the far wall, nothing in the way to trip her. She turned the light off, saving herself the walk back. She stumbled through the only door into her bedroom, sleepwalking through the routine. Enough light made it through the mini blinds, red neon from the gas station across the street, that she left the lamp off. First, she rearranged 2 of the long feather pillows on top of the double mattress that took up most of the space in the room into the vague shape of a human body. Then, the Ziploc bags full of Halloween costume blood were stuffed into the pillowcases. Close up, the blood wasn't very convincing, but the Ziplocs were for an attacker who broke the window, pushed the blinds aside, and shot from that vantage point. He wouldn't be able to detect the difference in the neon half-light. Next, the head. The mask she'd used was another after-Halloween sale acquisition, a parody of some political also-ran that had fairly realistic skin coloring. She'd stuffed it to roughly match the size of her own head and sewn a cheap brunette wig into place. Most important, a tiny wire, threaded up between the mattress and box spring, was hidden in the strands of nylon. A matching wire pierced through the pillow the head rested on. She yanked the sheet up, then the blanket, patted it all into shape, then twisted together the frayed ends of the two wires. It was a very tenuous joining. If she touched the head even lightly or jostled the pillow body a bit, the wires would slip silently apart. She stood back and gave the decoy a once-over through half-closed eyes. It wasn't her best work, but it did look like someone was asleep in the bed. Even if an intruder didn't believe it was Chris, he would still have to neutralize the sleeping body before he went on to search for her. Too tired to change into her pajamas, she just stepped out of her loose jeans. It was enough. She grabbed the fourth pillow and pulled her sleeping bag out from under the bed. They felt bulkier and heavier than usual. She dragged them into the compact bathroom, dumped them in the tub, and did the bare minimum of ablutions. No face washing tonight, just cleaning the teeth. The gun and the gas mask were both under the sink, hidden beneath a stack of towels. She pulled the mask over her head and tightened the straps, then clapped her palm over the filter port and inhaled through her nose to check the seal. The mask suctioned to her face just fine. It always did, but she never let familiarity or exhaustion make her skip the safety routine. She moved the gun into the wall-mounted soap dish within easy reach above the bathtub. She didn't love the gun. She was a decent shot compared with a totally untrained civilian, but not in the same class as a professional. She needed the option, though. Someday her enemies were going to figure her system out, and the people coming for her would be in gas masks, too. Honestly, she was surprised her shtick had saved her this long. With an unopened chemical absorption canister tucked under her bra strap, she shuffled the two steps back into the bedroom. She knelt beside the floor vent on the right side of the bed she'd never used. The vent cover grill probably wasn't as dusty as it should be. The grill's top screws were only halfway in, and the bottom screws were missing altogether. But she was sure no one looking through the window would notice these details or understand what they meant if he did. Sherlock Holmes was about the only person she wasn't worried would make an attempt on her life. She loosened the top screws and removed the grill. A few things would be immediately obvious to anyone who looked inside the vent. One, the back of the vent was sealed off, so it was no longer functional. Two, the large white bucket and the big battery pack probably didn't belong down there. She pried the lid off the bucket and was immediately greeted by the same chemical smell that infused the front room, so familiar she barely noted it. She reached into the darkness behind the bucket and pulled out first a small, awkward contraption with a coil, metal arms, and thin wires, then a glass ampoule about the size of her finger, and finally a rubber cleaning glove. She positioned the solenoid, the device she'd scavenged from a discarded washing machine, so that the arms extending from it were half submerged in the colorless liquid inside the bucket. She blinked hard twice, trying to force herself into alertness. This was the delicate part. She put the glove on her right hand, then pulled the canister free from her bra strap and held it ready in her left. With the gloved hand, she carefully inserted the ampoule into the grooves she'd drilled into the metal arms for this purpose. The ampoule rested just under the surface of the acid, the white powder inside it inert and harmless. However, if the current running through the wires that were attached so tenuously atop the bed were to be interrupted, the pulse would snap the solenoid shut, and the glass would shatter. The white powder would turn into a gas that was neither inert nor harmless. It was essentially the same arrangement that she had in the front room. The wiring was just simpler here. This trap was set only while she slept. She replaced the glove and the vent cover, and then, with a feeling that was not quite buoyant enough to be called relief, lurched back to the bathroom. The door, like the vent, might have tipped off someone as detail-oriented as Mr. Holmes. The soft rubber liners around all the edges were definitely not standard. They wouldn't entirely seal the bathroom off from the bedroom, but they would give her more time. She half fell into the tub, a slow-motion collapse onto the puffy sleeping bag. It had taken her a while to get used to sleeping in the mask, but now she didn't even think about it as she gratefully closed her eyes. She shimmied herself into the down and nylon cocoon, squirming till the hard square of her iPad was nestled against the small of her back. It was plugged into an extension cord that got power from the front room wiring. If the power fluctuated along that line, the iPad would vibrate. She knew from experience that it was enough to wake her, even as tired as she was tonight. She also knew that she could have the canister, still in her left hand, hugged tight against her chest like a child's teddy bear, unsealed and screwed into place on the gas mask in less than 3 seconds, despite being half awake in the dark and holding her breath. She'd practiced so many times, and then she'd proved herself during the 3 emergencies that had not been practice. She'd survived. Her system worked. Exhausted as she was, she had to let her mind tick over the evils of her day before it would let her be unconscious. It felt horrible, like phantom limb pain, not connected to any actual piece of her body, just there, anyway, knowing they'd found her again. She wasn't satisfied with her email response either. She'd come up with the plan too impulsively to be sure of it, and it required her to act more quickly than she'd like. She knew the theory. Sometimes if you ran headlong at the guy holding the gun, you could catch him off guard. Flight was always her favorite move, but she didn't see a way out of the alternative this time. Maybe tomorrow, after her tired brain had rebooted. Surrounded by her web, she slept. Chapter 2. As she sat waiting for Karsten to show, she thought about the other times the department had tried to kill her. Barnaby, Dr. Joseph Barnaby, her mentor, the last friend she'd known, had prepared her for the first attempt. But even with all his foresight, planning, and deep-rooted paranoia, it was just dumb luck in the form of an extra cup of black coffee that had saved her life. She hadn't been sleeping well. She'd worked with Barnaby for 6 years at that point, and a little more than halfway through that time, he'd told her his suspicions. At first, she hadn't wanted to believe he could be right. They were only doing their job as directed and doing it well. "You can't think of this as a long-term situation," he'd insisted, though he'd been in the same division for 17 years. "People like us, people who have to know things that no one wants us to know, eventually we become inconvenient. You don't have to do anything wrong. You can be perfectly trustworthy. They're the ones you can't trust." So much for working for the good guys. His suspicions had become more specific, then shifted into planning, which had evolved into physical preparation. Barnaby had been a big believer in preparation, not that it had done him any good in the end. The stress had begun to escalate in those last months as the date for the exodus approached, and, unsurprisingly, she'd had trouble sleeping. That particular April morning, it had taken 2 cups of coffee rather than the usual 1 to get her brain going. Add that extra cup to the smaller-than-average bladder in her smaller-than-average body, and you ended up with the doctor running to the can, too rushed to even log out, rather than sitting at her desk. And that's where she had been when the killing gas began filtering through the vents into the lab. Barnaby had been exactly where he was supposed to be. His screams had been his final gift to her, his last warning. They both had been sure that when the blow came, it wouldn't happen at the lab. Messy that way. Dead bodies usually raised a few eyebrows, and smart murderers tried to keep that kind of evidence as far removed from themselves as possible. They didn't strike when the victim was in their own living room. She should have known never to underestimate the arrogance of the people who wanted her dead. They didn't worry about the law. They were too cozy with the people who made those laws. She also should have respected the power of pure stupidity to take a smart person completely by surprise. The next 3 times had been more straightforward. Professional contractors, she assumed, given that they'd each worked alone. Only men so far, though a woman was always a possibility in the future. One man had tried to shoot her, one to stab her, and one to brain her with a crowbar. None of these tries had been effective because the violence had happened to pillows, and then her assailants had died. The invisible but very caustic gas had silently flooded the small room. It took about 2.5 seconds once the connection between the wires was broken. After that, the assassin was left with a life expectancy of approximately 5 seconds, depending on his height and weight. It would not have been a pleasant 5 seconds. Her bathtub mixture was not the same thing they'd used for Barnaby, but it was close enough. It was the simplest way she knew to kill someone so swiftly and so painfully. And it was a renewable resource, unlike many of her weapons. All she needed was a good stock of peaches and a pool supply store. Nothing that required restricted access or even a mailing address. Nothing that her pursuers could track. It really pissed her off that they'd managed to find her again. She'd been furious since waking yesterday and had only gotten angrier as the hours passed while she made her preparations. She had forced herself to nap and then drove all the next night in a suitable car, rented using a very weak ID for one Taylor Golding and a recently obtained credit card in the same name. Early this morning, she'd arrived in the city she least wanted to be in, and that had turned her anger up to the next level. She'd returned the car to a Hertz near Ronald Reagan National Airport, then walked across the street to another company and rented a new one with District of Columbia plates. 6 months ago, she would have done things differently. Gathered her belongings from the small house she was renting, sold her current vehicle on Craigslist, purchased a new one for cash from some private citizen who didn't keep records, and then driven aimlessly for a few days until she found a medium-sized city town that looked right. There, she'd start the process of staying alive all over again. But now there was that stupid, twisted hope that Karsten was telling the truth, a very anemic hope. It probably wouldn't have been enough motivation on its own. There was something else, a small but irritating worry that she had neglected a responsibility. Barnaby had saved her life again and again. Every time she survived another assassination attempt, it was because he had warned her, had educated her, had made her ready. If Karsten was lying to her, which she was 97% sure he was, and arranging an ambush, then everything he'd said was a lie, including the part about her being needed. And if they didn't need her, that meant they'd found someone else to do the job, someone as good as she had been. They might have replaced her a long time ago, might have assassinated a whole line of employees for all she knew, but she doubted it. While the department had money and access, the one thing it had in short supply was personnel. It took time to locate, cultivate, and train an asset like Barnaby or herself. People with those kinds of skills didn't grow in test tubes. She'd had Barnaby to save her. Who was going to save the dumb kid they'd recruited after her? The newcomer would be brilliant, just as she had been, but he or she would be blind to the most important element. Forget serving your country. Forget saving innocent lives. Forget the state-of-the-art facilities and the groundbreaking science and the unlimited budget. Forget the seven-figure salary. How about not being murdered? No doubt the person now holding her old position had no idea that his or her survival was even in question. She wished she had a way to warn that individual. Even if she couldn't spend all the time Barnaby had devoted to helping her. Even if it could be only one conversation. This is how they reward people like us. Get ready. But that wasn't an option. The morning was spent on more preparations. She checked into the Brascott, a small boutique hotel under the name Casey Wilson. The ID she used wasn't much more convincing than Taylor Golding's, but two of the phone lines were ringing as she registered, and the busy desk clerk wasn't paying close attention. There were rooms available this early, the clerk told her, but Casey would have to pay for an extra day, as check-in did not begin till 3. Casey agreed to the stipulation without complaint. The clerk seemed relieved. She smiled at Casey, really looking at her for the first time. Casey controlled her flinch. It didn't matter if this girl remembered Casey's face. Casey would make herself memorable enough in the next half hour. Casey used androgynous names on purpose. It was one of the strategies she'd gleaned from the case files Barnaby had fed her, something the real spies did. But it was also common sense, something the fiction writers had figured out as well. The logic was that if people were searching this hotel for a woman, they would start with the clearly female names in the register, like Jennifer and Kathy. It might take them another round to get to the Caseys and the Terrys and the Drews. Any time she could buy for herself was good. An extra minute might save her life. Casey shook her head at the eager bellman who stepped toward her, offering his services, and wheeled her single piece of luggage behind her to the elevator. She kept her face turned away from the camera over the control panel. Once inside the room, she opened the bag and removed a large briefcase and a zipper-top black tote. Other than these two things, her suitcase was empty. She took off the blazer that made her thin gray sweater and plain black pants look professional and hung it up. The sweater was pinned in the back to make it form-fitting. She removed the pins and let the sweater bag around her, changing her into someone a little smaller, maybe a bit younger. She removed her lipstick and rubbed off most of her eye makeup, then checked the effect in the large mirror over the dresser. Younger. Vulnerable. The baggy sweater suggested that she was hiding in it. She thought it would do. If she'd been going to see a female hotel manager, she would have played it slightly differently, perhaps tried to add some fake bruises with blue and black eyeshadow. But the name on the card at the desk downstairs was William Green, and she didn't think she would need to put in the extra time. It wasn't a perfect plan, and that bothered her. She would have liked to have another week just to review all the possible repercussions, but it was the best option she could set in motion with the time she'd had. It was probably overly elaborate, but it was too late to rethink it now. She called the desk and asked for Mr. Green. She was connected quickly.
"This is William Green. How can I help you?"
The voice was hearty and overly warm. She immediately had the mental image of a walrus of a man, bushy mustache included. "Yes, I hope I'm not bothering you."
"No, of course not, Ms. Wilson. I'm here to help in any way I can."
"I do need help, but it might sound a little odd. It's, hard to explain."
"Don't worry, miss. I'm sure I can be of assistance."
He sounded extremely confident. It made her wonder what kinds of odd requests he had fielded before. "Oh, dear," she dithered. "This might be easier in person." She made it into a question.
"Of course, Ms. Wilson. Fortunately, I will be available in 15 minutes. My office is on the first floor, just around the corner from the front desk. Will that suit?"
Fluttery and relieved. "Yes, thank you so much." She put the bags in the closet and carefully counted out the bills she needed from the stash in the large briefcase. She slipped this into her pockets, then waited 13 minutes. She took the stairs to avoid the elevator cameras. As Mr. Green ushered her into his windowless office, she was amused to see that her mental image had not been that far off. No mustache, no hair at all except for the barest hint of white eyebrows, but in all other ways very walrusy. It wasn't hard to play frightened, and halfway into her tale of her abusive ex-boyfriend who'd stolen the family heirlooms, she knew she had him. He bristled in a very male way, looking as if he wanted to rant about the sort of monsters who hit little women. But he mostly held his peace aside from several, "tut-tut, we'll take good care of you, you're safe here," kind of assurances. He probably would have helped her without the generous tip she gave him, but it certainly didn't hurt. He swore to tell only the members of the staff who were part of her plan, and she thanked him warmly. He wished her well and offered to bring the police in if that would help. Casey confessed with great sadness how ineffective the police and the restraining orders had been for her in the past. She implied that she could handle this alone as long as she had the help of a big, strong man like Mr. Green. He was flattered, and he hurried out to get everything ready. It wasn't the only time she'd played this card. Barnaby had suggested it initially, when their escape plan had reached the fine-tuning stage. At first, she had bristled at the idea, offended in some obscure way, but Barnaby was always practical. She was small and female in a lot of people's heads. That would always make her the underdog. Why not use this assumption to her advantage? Play the victim to keep from being one. Casey went back to her room and changed into the clothes she'd kept inside the briefcase, trading her sweater for a tight black V-neck tee and adding a thick black belt with intricately braided leatherwork. Everything she took off had to fit back into the briefcase because she was leaving the suitcase and she wouldn't be returning to this hotel. She was already armed. She never went out without taking some precautions. But now she moved to the high-alert version of her personal protection, arming herself to the literal teeth, or to the tooth, really. She inserted a fake crown full of something much less painful than cyanide, but just as deadly. It was the oldest trick in the book for a reason. It worked. And sometimes, the last move you had was permanently extracting yourself from the hands of your enemies. The big black tote bag had two ornamental wooden pieces at the apex of the shoulder strap. Inside the tote was her special jewelry in little padded boxes. Every piece was one of a kind and irreplaceable. She would never again have the access to acquire ornamental tools like these, so she was very careful with her treasures. Three rings, one rose gold, one yellow gold, one silver. They all had small barbs hidden under clever little twisting hatches. The color of the metal indicated which substance coated the barb. Very straightforward, probably expected from her. Next, the earrings, which she always handled with delicate care. She wouldn't risk wearing them for this part of the journey. She would wait until she was closer to her target. Once they were in, she had to move her head very deliberately. They looked like simple glass globes, but the glass was so thin that a high note could shatter it, especially as the little spheres were already under pressure from the inside. If anyone grabbed her by the neck or head, the glass would burst with a quiet pop. She would hold her breath, which she could do, for a minute 15 easy, and close her eyes if possible. Her attacker would not know to do that. Around her neck went a largish silver locket. It was very conspicuous and would command the attention of anyone who knew who she truly was. There was nothing deadly about it, though. It was just a distraction from the real dangers. Inside was a photo of a pretty little girl with fluffy, straw-colored hair. The child's full name was handwritten on the back of the picture. It looked like something a mother or an aunt would wear. However, this particular girl was Karsten's only grandchild. Hopefully, if it was too late for Casey, the person who found her body would be a real cop who, due to the lack of identification, would be forced to dig into this evidence and bring her murder around to the doorstep where it ultimately belonged. It probably wouldn't really hurt Karsten, but it might make things inconvenient for him, might make him feel threatened or worry that she'd released other information elsewhere. Because she knew enough about hidden disasters and classified horrors to do much more than inconvenience Karsten. But even now, 3 years past her first death sentence, she hadn't grown comfortable with the idea of treason or the very real possibility of causing a panic. There was no way to foresee the potential damage of her revelations, the harm they might cause to innocent citizens. So she'd settled for just making Karsten think that she had done something so reckless. Maybe the worry would give him an aneurysm. A pretty little locket filled with drippings of revenge to make losing the game more palatable. The cord the locket was attached to, however, was deadly. It had the tensile strength of airline cable in proportion to its size and was easily strong enough to garrote a person. The cord closed with a magnet rather than a clasp. She had no desire to be lassoed with her own weapon. The wooden embellishments on her tote's shoulder strap had slots where the ends of the cords fit. Once the cord was in place, the wooden pieces became handles. Physical force wasn't her first choice, but it would be unexpected. It gave her an advantage to be ready. Inside the intricate patterns of her black leather belt were hidden several spring-loaded syringes. She could pull them individually or flip a mechanism that would expose all the sharp ends at once if an attacker pressed her close to his body. The mix of the different substances would not blend well in his system. Scalpel blades with taped edges were tucked into her pockets. Standard shoe knives, one that popped forward, one to the rear. Two cans labeled pepper spray in her bag, one containing the real thing, the other with something more permanently debilitating. A pretty perfume bottle that released gas, not liquid. What looked like a tube of chapstick in her pocket. And several other fun options just in case. Plus, the little thing she'd brought for the unlikely outcome. Success. A bright yellow lemon-shaped squeeze bottle, matches, a travel-size fire extinguisher. And cash. Plenty of it. She stuck a key card in the tote. She wouldn't come back to this hotel. But if things went well, someone else would. She had to move carefully when she was in full armor like this, but she'd practiced enough that she was confident in her walk. It was comforting to know that if anyone caused her to move less carefully, he'd be the worse for it. She left the hotel, nodding to the clerk who had checked her in, a briefcase in one hand and the black tote over her arm. She got into her car and drove to a crowded park near the middle of the city. She left the car in an adjacent strip mall's lot on the north side and walked into the park. She was quite familiar with this park. There was a bathroom near the southeast corner that she headed into now. As she'd expected, mid-morning on a school day, it was empty. Out of the briefcase came another set of clothes. There was also a rolled-up backpack and some more accessories. She changed her clothes, put her previous outfit in the briefcase, and then shoved it and the tote into the large backpack. When she walked out of the bathroom, she was no longer immediately recognizable as a she. She slouched away toward the south end of the park, loose-kneed, concentrating on keeping her hips from swaying and giving her away. Though it didn't appear that anyone was looking, it was always smarter to act like someone was. The park started to fill up when lunchtime approached, as she'd known it would. No one paid attention to the androgynous kid sitting on a bench in the shade, furiously texting on a smartphone. No one came close enough to see that the phone wasn't on. Across the street from the bench was Karsten's favorite lunch spot. It was not the meeting place she'd suggested. She was also 5 days early. Behind the men's sunglasses, her eyes scanned the sidewalks. This might not work. Maybe Karsten had changed his habits. Habits were, after all, dangerous things. Like the expectation of safety. She'd sifted through the advice that both the factual accounts and the novels had given on disguises, always focusing on the common sense stuff. Don't slap on a platinum wig and high heels just because you're a short brunette. Don't think opposite. Think inconspicuous. Think about what attracts attention, like blondes and stilettos, and avoid it. Play to your strengths. Sometimes what you believe makes you unattractive can keep you alive. Back in the normal days, she'd resented her boyish frame. Now she used it. If you put on a baggy jersey and a pair of well-worn jeans a size too big, any eyes looking for woman might slide right over boy. Her hair was short as a boy's and easy to hide under a ball cap. And layered sock inside a pair of too large Reeboks gave her that puppy-pawed look of the average teenage male. Someone who really looked at her face might notice some discrepancies. But why would anyone look? The park was filling with people of all ages and sexes. She did not stand out, and no one hunting for her would expect her to be here. She hadn't been back to D.C. since the department's first attempt to murder her. This wasn't her forte. Leaving her web, hunting. But it was, at least, something she'd put some thought into beforehand. Most of what she did in an average day took only a small part of her attention and intelligence. The rest of her mind was always working through possibilities, imagining scenarios. It made her slightly more confident now. She was working from a mental map that had been many months in the creation. Karsten had not changed his habits. At exactly 12:15, he sat down at a metal bistro table in front of his cafe. He'd picked the one that was angled so he could be completely covered by the umbrella's shade, as she'd expected. Karsten had once been a redhead. He didn't have much of the hair anymore, but he still had the complexion. The waitress waved to him, nodded toward the pad of paper in her hand, then went back inside. So he had a usual order, another habit that could get you killed. If Casey had wanted Karsten dead, she could have managed it without his ever knowing she had been here. She got up, shoved the phone in her pocket, and slung her backpack onto one shoulder. The sidewalk led behind a rise and some trees. Karsten couldn't see her here. It was time for another costume. Her posture changed. The hat came off. She shrugged out of the jersey she'd layered over the t-shirt. She tightened the belt and rolled up the bottom inches of the jeans, turning them into a boyfriend cut look. The Reeboks came off and traded places with the slip-on ballet slash athletic shoes from the backpack. She did all this casually, as if she were hot and just stripping down a bit. The weather made it believable. Bystanders might have been surprised to see a girl under the masculine clothing, but she doubted this moment would linger in anyone's memory. There were too many more extreme styles on display in the park today. The sunshine always did bring out the freaks in D.C. Her tote went over her shoulder again. She dropped the backpack behind an out-of-the-way tree while no one was looking. If someone found it, there was nothing inside that she couldn't live without. Decently certain that no one could see her, she added a wig and then, finally, carefully, she threaded her earrings into place. She could have confronted Karsten in her boyish garb, but why give up any secrets? Why let him connect her to her surveillance? If he'd even noticed the boy, that is. She might need to be a boy again soon, so she would not waste the persona now. And she could have saved some time by wearing the costume from the hotel, but if she'd made no changes to her appearance, the image of her captured by the closed-circuit security cameras at the hotel could be easily linked to the footage from any public or private cameras picking her up now. By spending extra time on her appearance, she'd broken as many links as she could. If someone was trying to find the boy, or the businesswoman, or the casual park visitor she was now, he would have a complicated trail to follow. It was cooler in her female outfit. She let the light breeze dry the sweat that had been building up under the nylon jersey, and then walked out to the street. She came at him from behind, taking the same path he had just a few minutes earlier. His food had arrived, a chicken parm, and he seemed to be totally absorbed in consuming it. But she knew Karsten was better than she was at appearing to be something he was not. She dropped into the seat across from him with no fanfare. His mouth was full of sandwich when he looked up. She knew that he was a good actor. She assumed he would bury his true reaction and display the emotion he wished before she could catch sight of the first. Because he didn't look surprised at all, she assumed she'd taken him completely unawares. If he had been expecting her, he would have acted like her sudden appearance had shocked him. But this, the steady gaze across the table, the unwidened eyes, the methodical chewing, this was him controlling his surprise. She was almost 80% sure. She didn't say anything. She just met his expressionless gaze while he finished masticating his bite of sandwich.
"I guess it would be too easy to just meet as planned," he said.
"Too easy for your sniper, sure." She said the words lightly, using the same volume he had. Anyone overhearing would think the words a joke. But the two other lunch groups were talking and laughing loudly. The people passing by on the sidewalk listened to earphones and telephones. No one cared what she was saying, except Karsten.
"That was never me, Juliana. You must know that."
It was her turn to act unsurprised. It had been so long since anyone had addressed her by her real name. It sounded like a stranger's. After the initial jolt, she felt a small wave of pleasure. It was good that her name sounded foreign to her. That meant she was doing it right. Her eyes flitted to her obvious wig. It was actually quite similar to her real hair, but now he would suspect she was hiding something very different. Then he forced his eyes back to hers. He waited for a response for another moment, but when she didn't speak, he continued, choosing his words carefully.
The parties who decided you should retire have fallen into disfavor. It was never a popular decision to begin with, and now those of us who were always in disagreement are no longer ruled by those parties.
It could be true. It probably wasn't. He answered the skepticism in her eyes.
Have you had any unpleasant disturbances in the past 9 months?
And here I was thinking that I'd just gotten better at playing hide-and-seek than you.
It's over, Julie. Might has been overcome by right.
I love happy endings. Heavy sarcasm. He winced, hurt by the sarcasm, or pretending to be.
Not so happy as all that, he said slowly. A happy ending would mean I wouldn't have contacted you. You would have been left alone for the rest of your life, and it would have been a long one, as much as that was in our power.
She nodded as if she agreed, as if she believed. In the old days, she'd always assumed Karsten was exactly what he appeared to be. He had been the face of the good guys for a long time. It was almost fun now, in a strange way, like a game, to try to decipher what each word actually meant. Except then there was the tiny voice that asked, "What if there is no game? What if this is true? If I could be free?"
You were the best, Juliana.
Dr. Barnaby was the best.
I know you don't want to hear this, but he never had your talent.
Thank you. He raised his eyebrows. Not for the compliment, she explained. Thank you for not trying to tell me his death was an accident. All of this still in the light-hearted tone.
It was a poor choice, motivated by paranoia and disloyalty. A person who will sell out his partner always sees the partner as plotting in exactly the same way. Dishonest people don't believe honest people exist.
She kept her face stony while he spoke. Never in 3 years of constant running had she ever spilled a single secret that she'd been privy to. Never once had she given her pursuers any reason to think her a traitor. Even as they tried to kill her, she had remained faithful. And that hadn't mattered to her department, not at all. Not much did matter to them. She was distracted for a moment by the memory of how close she had been to what she was looking for. The place she might have reached by now on her most pressing avenue of research and creation, if she hadn't been interrupted. That project had not mattered to them either, apparently.
But the egg is on those disloyal faces now, Karsten continued. Because we never found anyone as good as you. Hell, we never found anyone half as good as Barnaby. It amazes me how people can forget that true talent is a limited commodity.
He waited, clearly hoping she would speak, hoping she would ask something, betray some sign of interest. She just stared at him politely, the way someone would look at the stranger ringing her up at a register. He sighed, and then leaned in, suddenly intent.
We have a problem. We need the kind of answers only you can give us. We don't have anyone else who can do this job, and we can't screw this one up.
You, not we, she said simply.
I know you better than that, Juliana. You care about the innocents.
I used to. You could say that part of me was murdered. Karsten winced again.
Juliana, I'm sorry. I've always been sorry. I tried to stop them. I was so relieved when you slipped through their fingers, every time you slipped through their fingers.
She couldn't help but be impressed he was admitting all of it. No denials, no excuses, none of the "it was just an unfortunate accident at the lab" kind of thing she had been expecting. No, it wasn't us,
It was enemies of the state. No stories, just acknowledgement.
And now everyone is sorry.
His voice dropped, and she had to listen hard to make out his words.
Because we don't have you, and people are going to die, Juliana. Thousands of people. Hundreds of thousands.
He waited this time while she thought it over. It took her a few minutes to examine all the possible angles. She spoke quietly, too, now, but made sure there was no interest or emotion in her voice, just stating obvious facts to move the conversation forward. You know someone who has vital information. Karsten nodded. You can't take him or her out, because that would let others know that you are aware of them, which would expedite whatever course of action you would prefer not to happen. Another nod. We're talking about the bad stuff here, yes? A sigh. Nothing worked the department up like terrorism. She'd been recruited before the emotional dust had entirely settled around the hole where the Twin Towers used to stand. Preventing terrorism had always been the main component of her job, the best justification for it. The threat of terrorism had also been manipulated, turned, and twisted, till by the end she'd lost a lot of faith in the idea that she was actually doing the work of a patriot. And a large device, she said. Not a question. The biggest boogeyman was always this, that at some point, someone who truly hated the United States would get his or her hands on something nuclear. That was the dark shadow that hid her profession from the eyes of the world, that made her so indispensable, no matter how much Joe Citizen wanted to think she didn't exist. And it had happened, more than once. People like her had kept those situations from turning into massive human tragedies. It was a trade-off. Small-scale horror versus wholesale slaughter. Karsten shook his head, and suddenly his pale eyes were haunted. She couldn't help but shudder a little internally, as she realized it was door number two. There were only ever two fears that big. It's biological. She didn't say the words out loud, just mouthed them. Karsten's bleak expression was her answer. She looked down for a moment, sorting through all of his responses, and reducing them to two columns, two lists of possibilities in her head. Column one. Karsten was a talented liar who was saying things he thought would motivate her to visit a place where people were better prepared to dispose of Juliana Fortis forever. He was thinking quickly on his feet, pushing her most sensitive buttons. Column two. Someone had a biological weapon of mass destruction, and the powers that be didn't know where it was or when it would be used. But they knew someone who did. Vanity carried some weight, shifting the balance slightly. She knew she was good. It was true that they probably hadn't found someone better. Still, she would put her money on column one.
Jules, I don't want you dead, he said quietly, guessing her train of thought. I wouldn't have contacted you if that were the case. I wouldn't want to meet with you, because I am certain you have at least six ways to kill me on your person right now, and every reason in the world to use one of them.
You really think I would come with only six? She asked. He frowned nervously for a second, then decided to laugh.
You make my point for me. I don't have a death wish, Jules. I'm on the level.
He eyed the locket around her neck, and she suppressed a smile. She returned to her light voice. I would prefer it if you called me Dr. Fortis. I think we're past the point of nicknames. He made a hurt face.
I'm not asking you to forgive me. I should have done more.
She nodded, though again she wasn't agreeing with him. She was just moving the conversation along.
I'm asking you to help me. No, not me. To help the innocent people who are going to die if you don't.
If they die, it's not on me.
I know, Doctor, I know. It will be on me. But who's to blame won't really matter to them. They'll be dead.
She held his gaze. She wouldn't be the one to blink. His expression shifted to something darker.
Would you like to hear what it will do to them?
No.
It might be too much even for your stomach.
I doubt it. But it doesn't really matter. What might happen is secondary.
I'd like to know what is more important than hundreds of thousands of American lives.
It's going to sound horribly selfish, but breathing in and out has sort of trumped everything else for me.
You can't help us if you're dead,
Karsten said bluntly.
The lesson has been learned. This won't be the last time we'll need you. We won't make the same mistake again.
She hated to buy into this, but the balance was shifting even more. What Karsten was saying did make sense. She was certainly no stranger to policy changes. What if it was all true? She could play cold, but Karsten knew her well. She would have a difficult time living with a disaster of this magnitude if she thought there was any chance she could have done something. That was how, in the beginning, they'd roped her into possibly the worst profession in the entire world. I don't suppose you have the files on you, she said. Chapter 3. Tonight, her name was Alex. She'd needed to put a little distance between herself and D.C., and she'd ended up in a small motel just north of Philadelphia. It was one of a half a dozen that lined the interstate on the way out of the city. It would take any tracker a while to search all of them, even if he first somehow narrowed down her position to this part of town. She'd left no trail to even get a hunter to Pennsylvania. Regardless, she'd be sleeping in the bathtub tonight as usual. There was no table in the small room, so she had all the files laid out on the bed. Just looking at them exhausted her. It had not been a simple matter of having Karsten FedEx them somewhere. The information was ready, Karsten had told her. He'd been hopeful that she would meet with him, and he would have brought the files with him if he'd been expecting her. She insisted on hard copies, and he agreed. She gave him the delivery instructions. The difficulty was breaking the connection on both ends. For example, she couldn't just have Karsten dump the files into a trash can and hire someone to pick them up for her. It was too easy for people to keep an eye on that trash can. The watchers would see the person who picked the files up and then follow that person. That person could take the files to a separate drop spot before she came near them, but the eyes would already be there. Somewhere along the line, the package had to be out of the observer's sight long enough for her to perform a complex little shell game. So, Karsten had, as instructed, left a box for her at the front desk of the Brayscott Hotel. Mr. Green was ready. He thought Karsten was a friend who had stolen back those family heirlooms from the violent ex, who was surely following him. Mr. Green had given her the code so she could remotely watch the hotel's video surveillance feed from an internet cafe miles away. Just because she hadn't seen people following Karsten didn't mean they weren't there, but he appeared to simply deliver the box and walk away. The manager did a good job of following all her instructions, most likely because he knew she was watching. The box went into the service elevator and down to the laundry, where it was transferred to a maid's cart, delivered to her room, and then put into her inconspicuous black suitcase by the bike messenger, to whom she'd given the key card and $500. The bike messenger had taken a circuitous route, following the instructions she'd given him over a cheap prepaid phone that she'd already disposed of, and eventually dropped the box with a confused salesperson at the copy store across the street from the cafe. Hopefully, the watchers were still back at the hotel, waiting for her to walk through the front door. Probably they were smarter, but even if there were 10 watchers, there wouldn't have been enough to follow every stranger who walked out of the hotel. If one had attached himself to her messenger, he would have had a hard time keeping up. She could only cross her fingers that no one was watching now. She'd had to move fast. That next hour was the most dangerous part of her plan. Of course, she'd known there would be some kind of tracking device hidden in the materials. She'd told Karsten she would scan for a trick like this, but perhaps he'd guessed that she didn't have the tech to do that.
As quickly as possible, she made a set of colored duplicates. It took 15 minutes, much too long. The duplicates went back into the suitcase, and the originals went into a paper bag that the girl at the counter gave her. She left the box in the garbage there. The clock was really against her now. She'd climbed in a cab and had the driver head toward a rougher part of D.C. while she looked for the first place that would give her the privacy she needed. She didn't have time to be picky, and she ended up having the cabbie wait for her at the end of an unsavory alley. It was the kind of behavior he would definitely remember, but there was no help for it. They could be watching her already. She hurried to the bottom of the dead-end alley, what a place to be caught, stepped behind a dumpster, and cleared a spot on the broken asphalt with her foot. The sound of movement behind her made her jump and spin around, her hand on the thick black belt at her waist, her fingers automatically seeking the thin syringe hidden farthest to the left. Across the alley, a dazed-looking man on a bed of cardboard and rags was watching her with a mesmerized expression, but he said nothing and made no move to either leave or approach. She didn't have time to think about what he would see. Keeping the homeless man in her peripheral vision, she turned her focus to the bag of original documents. She pulled her lemon-shaped squeeze bottle out of her handbag and squirted it into the paper bag. The smell of gasoline saturated the air around her. The man's expression didn't change. Then she lit the match. She watched the burn carefully, the fire extinguisher in her hands now in case the flames started to spread. The homeless man seemed bored by this part. He turned his back to her. She waited until every scrap was ash before she doused the flame. She didn't know what was in the files yet, but it would assuredly be very sensitive. She had never worked on a project that wasn't. She rubbed the toe of her shoe across the black and gray powder, grinding it into the pavement. There wasn't a fragment left, she was sure. She tossed a five to the man on the cardboard before she ran back to the cab. From there, it was a series of cabs, two rides on the metro, and a few blocks on foot. She couldn't be sure that she'd lost them. She could only do her best and be ready. Another cab landed her in Alexandria, where she rented a third car on a third brand-new credit card. And now she was outside of Philly in this cheap hotel room, a heavily perfumed deodorizer warring with the smell of stale cigarette smoke, staring at the neat stacks of paper laid out on the bed. The subject's name was Daniel Nebaker Beach. He was 29, fair-skinned, tall, medium build, medium ash-brown hair with longish waves. The length surprised her for some reason, perhaps because she so often dealt with military men. Hazel eyes. He was born in Alexandria to Alan Jeffrey Beach and Tina Ann Beach née Nebaker. One sibling, Kevin, 18 months older. His family had lived in Maryland for most of his childhood, except for a brief stretch